Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chapter 15, Beneath the Beating Sun, from the book Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, a 850-page tome, and up to around page 256. And we've had various looks at the sun. It's been a general pulling together of huge amounts of stories and information out of this man's brain. Quite amazing. But some of the stuff is not scientifically spot on, but in general it's quite good. Now, this is a quote from Rudyard Kipling, "Dear Auntie, your parboiled nephew." Now, parboiled means you pre-cook it a little bit before you cook it. "The heavens are red hot, and the earth is burning brass. The river glares in the sun like a torrent of molten glass, and the quivering heat haze rises, the pitiless sunlight glows, till my cart rains blisters my fingers as my spectacles blisters my nose, heat like a baker's oven that sweats down to the bone. Never such heat and such health your power-boiled nephew known." Okay, well, I don't quite understand what that means. "I'm a typically fair-skinned Englishman, ginger-haired and freckled. Even a few minutes under the sun, and any areas I have left uncovered will turn unsightly red, painful reminder that the rays produce not only vitamins, they also scorch." Okay, so vitamin D is made, and so vitamin is an amino acid, basically a compound, it's a nutrient which you cannot actually produce yourself, but in the case of vitamin D, you do produce it yourself, but you require sunlight to produce it. From the Richard childhood afternoons on, I have been aware that the sun can do to the body, even though my experience have generally been British summers, the mildest broiling possible. In recent years, I have stood in the middle of the Arizona desert, where the temperature is over 49 degrees Celsius, and pondered what it must be like to be burnt alive. The force of the southwestern sun bleeds colour out of the fabrics and wood faster than anywhere else on the continent. But even that heat does not come close to matching the hottest surface temperature ever recorded, 58 degrees, in 1922 in the Libyan Sahara. In the US, Greenland Ranch, California, seared to 134 degrees Fahrenheit, whatever that means, very close to it, in 1913, holds the official records, although the true all-time high is most likely endured during the 43 consecutive days between the 6th of July and 17th of August in Death Valley, California. So named in 1849 by one of the 18 survivors of a party of 30 that attempted a short cut to the gold fields. In his book Equator, Thirst, and that's what the interesting, where the gold fields, you know, what the actual the origin of that. In his book The Equator, Thurston Clark describes the journey he made in 1986, stopping off at points along the 0 degree latitude easterly of the French Martinique in the Caribbean to Mark Cami in the Ecuador, whose name is the Spanish name for equator. "I've come to a connoisseur of heat," he writes at the outset, and indeed he creates a convincing taxonomy of the subject. "There's heat that reflects off the coral and scorches and softens the face like tomato held over a fire. There's the greasy heat of a tropical city, the milky heat that steams a jungle river like a pan of a near-boiled water, a blinding heat that explodes at the roof like the paparazzi's flashbulbs, and the heat so lazy and intoxicating that all day you feel as though you are walking from a wine-drugged nap." He reaches Lambrinchne, the island where Albert Schweitzer established his mission in the swamps of the Uguri, principal river of Gabon in western Central Africa. He says he feels as if wrapped in hot towels, and recounts the time that the Le Grand Doctor, making his sweat-soaked rounds, was asked whether such heats bothered him. He never permitted himself to think about it, he said, then added, "You must have a great spiritual activity to fight heat." A handful of great men throughout history, George Washington, General MacArthur among them, have added their aura of majesty to apparently not sweating at all. Barack Obama is said to be one of their members. Well, why would you? I've never heard that one before. Heat has long been the enemy of the unprepared traveller, particularly soldiers on the move. In June 1578, Sebastian I of Portugal took a large force to northwest Africa, where his armour grew so hot that he had to have water poured all over his body under the metal plates, and suffering of his troops, who could not afford this luxury, must have been extraordinary. The army was annihilated, a prelude to a run of disasters. Within 3 years, Portugal had fallen to the Spanish Habsburg in China. At around the same period, a different kind of army was under the hot sun. Coolies digging canals entered each day with its backs chapped like scales of a fish. Some historians still perpetuate the legend that when, on the 24th of June, 1812, Napoleon and his grand army of nearly half a million crossed the river Niemen and headed towards Moscow, they were destroyed by the cold. But by the time the army reached Smolensk in mid-August, a third had indeed been lost, but to a weeks-long heat wave. Perry Burick comments in War and Peace, "Russia had hot weathers. Russia and hot weather don't go together." Isn't that amazing? So it's the heat wave that also did them in. The sun imposes a steep threshold of effort in a very short time, and wise generals seek to protect the troops from the heat of the day. But sometimes military tradition or plain ignorance trumps common sense. Scottish Highland regiments, for instance, got up in kilts, found the backs of the legs charred, especially after being skirmishing line on their bearers, compromising their ability to march. For centuries, British troops died routinely feet stroke during battle because there was no drill for taking off one's coat, a deadly tradition that continued well into the 20th century. In the western desert of Egypt and Libya, open-neck shorts and shirts were quartermasters. They're quartermasters, you know, the fact that the best way to keep the sun off would have been with loose-fitting, lightweight clothes that covered more skin. Certainly, Indians have long understood this and dressed accordingly with good reason. The country seems to have been the most systematically awful place for heat, a place where things teem almost, where unfriendly microorganisms and long-lasting infections conspire against you. Harry, Olivia's lover in Ruth Paws, Jabalvar's Heat and Dust, explains, "I stayed in my room all day yesterday and this morning. What else could I do in this hideous, terrible heat? Have you looked outside? Have you seen what it's like? No wonder everyone goes mad." A junior officer of the Raj who failed to wear his troopy sun helmet outdoors would be confined to barracks for 14 days. For the British, going out in the midday became almost an act of impiety, certainly of self-destruction. Karan, the broken protagonist of Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King, dies after wandering bareheaded at noon for a mere half hour. Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Noel Card's famous ditty begins. In tropical chimes, there are certain times of day when all the citizens retire to tear off their clothes and perspire. It's one of those rules that the greatest of fools obeys because the sun is much too sultry and one must avoid the ultraviolet ray. The song had its origin in Coward's disdain for British colonial society, whose refusal to adapt to foreign habits be observed in Malaya, which he visited in 1930. During a later car ride from Hipong to Saigon, he composed the whole piece entirely in his head. He may have been inspired by Kipling, who wrote in Kim, quote, a story called Kim, that only the devils and the English walk to and fro without reason. And later, we walk as though we were mad or English. But the phrase is Howard's. Outposts of the British Empire assemble and provide a welcoming climate, and the lack of knowledge about how to deal with the weather extremes accounted for much suffering, even loss of life. Charles Sturt, leader of the Royal Geographical Society's 1844 expedition into Australia's deserts in search of the legendary inland sea, recorded, quote, "So great is the heat that our hair has ceased to grow, our nails have become as brittle as glass, and scurvy itself upon us all. We're attacked by violent headaches, pains in limbs and swollen and ulcerated gums." In British East Africa, modern Kenya, in the early days of the 20th century, everyone buttoned on spine pads of quilted flannel, as it was believed that the sun affected the backbone. Men wore cummerbands under their revolvers to protect their spleens, while people with metal-roofed houses at high altitude wore hats indoors, as they thought the sun penetrated iron. There you go, that's pretty stupid. Now, the first permanent doctor in Nairobi, setting up the practice in 1913, held that people with blue eyes should wear dark glasses, and everything should be lined with red, a colour believed to modify solar rays. Try as they might, the colonial British was trapped. In his fine study of the Indian Mutiny, Richard Collier writes, "At dawn 14, June 57, impeccably, the sun rose above Kanpore. Even in other years, granted the gift of shade, such heat had driven men to lock themselves in darkened rooms and blow out their brains. On this day, five, perhaps six, people within Sir Hugh Wheeler's entrenchment would die of sunstroke. A band of steel seemed to encase the temples, followed by a great drowsiness. They sank vomiting to their knees, face blackened as they died. Today, some muskets would split apart like firecrackers, touched off by the sun. From the mud walls, men would see across the arid sandy plain a strange chimera of forest glades and blue sparkling water. Against their wills, they would suck in the unbreathable smell of entrenchment, like the contents of a thousand privies rotting beneath the sun. Small children pleading for a drink of water would be told to suck on the leather strap to quench their thirst." Even before the uprising, life had been barely tolerable. Families sat in semi-darkness, officers in undressed summer uniforms, their ladies in loose white muslin. Church services, so much part of the empire, were kept brief, but because of the heat, few would kneel to worship in one Calcutta station. The British did not know it, but they were really fighting a losing battle against the sun. A sun that caused tempers to flare murderously, that made social standards at the time of rigid importance, at other times a burden not worth shouldering. For 8 months of the year, the sun was the monstrous weight pressing down on their lives, curtailing moving, hedging the darkness of rooms. The sun sent pianos out of tune, dried ink in as it touched paper, melted the peaks of officers' bell-shaped shakers, tall cylindrical caps, to sticky black glue. By a common consent, the greatest beauty had the palest cheeks in the station. Houses were designed with one purpose, to cheat the sun of victory. Intense heat of this kind brings illness peculiar to equatorial countries such as malaria, where the sweat collects beneath the skin, one of the commonest diseases of the soldiers fighting the tropics during the Second World War. Tropical acne, cataracts, collagenic urethra, an eruption of 1 to 3 millimeter welts, mainly on the torso, phototoxicity, photoallergy, eruptions caused by interactions between drugs and sunlight, solar eczema, homopolar ringworm, in which the worm rises, bumps in the skin where the hair doesn't grow. Such diseases accounted for 12% of all outpatient victims in the Vietnam War. Great heat has ever been wrapped in fear and superstition. In ancient Greece, high noon was when the demons came out, and it's no accident that Pan, a distinctly sinister god, is the lord of noon. Of course, all religions are not created equal. The incidence of sunshine over the earth varies from over 4,000 hours per year, more than 90% of the longest period possible, to fewer than 2,000. Sahara gets the most. Areas around Iceland and Scotland gets the least. Until the current era of extreme population mobility, a person's skin colour was likely to be influenced by where he or she lived. Around the equator, dark-skinned people would prevail because the skin contains above-average amounts of melanin, a pigment that is also sunblock, which helps them adapt to areas saturated with sunlight. Light-skinned people would be more common around the poles. Skin colour has become to have symbolic and even moral values divorced from its origin. So throughout human history, it has been used to assess the relative superiority of races as well as professional classes. A science writer, Jonathan Weiner, has noted that skin colour, the biggest visible difference between populations of human beings on the planet, around which so many bitter and divisive myths have been spun, is really nothing more than a schematic diagram of the planetary's level of ultraviolet radiation. Some dark-skinned people hold that, as their colour shows that they are nearer the sun, it also implies greater closeness to God. But in general, there's been countries to be prejudiced against darker skins in much of the world. Common definitions of blackness listed in the OED, some dating back from 1500s, include foul, dirty, wicked, horrible. Barack Obama tells in Dreams of My Father, a flickering through an old copy of Life magazine when he was a child and coming across a picture of a man who had been chemically treated to lighten his complexion. Skin, writes the president, has a ghostly hue as if blood had been drawn from the flesh. The man expressed some regret about trying to pass himself off, as a white man, and sorry about how badly things had turned out. But the results were irreversible. Then there were thousands of people like him, black men and women in America, who'd undergone the same treatment in response to the advertisement that promised happiness as a white person. Even when it didn't have racial and racist implications, the prejudice favouring lighter skin has been consistent throughout the ages, partly because skin colour has served as a signifier of social, economic and religious standing, since those who performed manual labours outdoors were much more likely to be tanned than those whose professions were paid better and highly esteemed, or those who were wealthy enough that they did not have to do work at all. In Minoan Crete, 2600 BC, on women kept out of the light to maintain an ethereal appearance. There's a star here. This person's got incredible brain power, hasn't he? This is a footnote. As against this, there's the odd fact that ancient Greek sanctuary, It is said that Rhodes and Athens, Olympia alone, the extraordinary figure of 73,000 statues would have been seen. If we disbelieve this estimate, Pliny the Elder more reliably informs us that statues per city still numbered in their thousands, and that one could go nowhere in Greek world without encountering lifestyles, bronze, simulacrum. Many statues were painted stone or polychrome or gilded wood, but more suggested that had been bronze, though we do not know exactly what kind of colour that would have been, as to be perfect or at least inviolate. What must have been like to have lived among such figures would have suggested to be suntanned was to emulate the gods. Now, this is actually quite interesting because this book here said the Colossus of Rhodes was a sun cult. Rhodes has a sun cult, but I can't remember if you remember that. From the mid-20th century, European women were whitening their skins with potions every bit as disastrous as the one used by the man in life. Arsenic is a skin whitener of choice, even though its deadly properties were well known, as shown during the Italian Renaissance when Giulia Toffana created an arsenic-based powder designed for wealthy women to kill their husbands. The women applied the powder to both the pendera of their cheeks. Husbands who kissed too passionately rarely survived. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Some 600 widowhood later, Toffana was detected and put to death. But still women whiten their faces with arsenic. Not only on their faces, in 1772, British ladies started bleaching their hands with the poison to give them the porcelain tone, prompting the great potter Joshua Wedgwood to advertise black teapots against which the backgrounds of the hands of the hostess looked even whiter. Shakespeare seems not to have shared this preference. Three of his most delightful heroines are described as sun-browned: Olivia, Twelfth Night; Julia in 12 Gentlemen of Verona; and Beatrice in Much Ado. He himself had a sonnet, 62, was berated and chopped with tanned antiquity. He realises when looking at the mirror, he was certainly well aware of the prejudice of the day. And in sonnet 1727 asserts that, in old age, black is not counted fair, nor, if it were, it bore not beauty's name. Isn't that beautiful? This person's got a huge encyclopedic brain. I've read Shakespearean sonnets. Unfortunately, there's some I really, really like, but they're just so hard to reread and get into. During the reign of Elizabeth I, some women were keen to appear pale-skinned, that they used whitening agents that contained lead oxide, which accumulated in the body and brought on grave pathologies, even paralysis and death. Others spread egg whites over their faces to obtain the glazed look and painted them thin blue lines on their foreheads to give off a translucent glow. This is just mad. It is even better to be blue-blooded, meaning high-born. There were several possible origins for this term. It is a custom in late summer for gentry to help gather in the harvest and expose their arms. Their skins would be pale, so their veins showed up blue, and labourers believed the masters had blue blood. Another explanation comes from the explanation of Charles I in 1649, where he wore a white shirt. This would have been washed in a solution of calcium hypochlorite, which is pool chlorine, which chemical, when it comes in contact with blood, provides a brilliant blue stain. Oh, wow. While both explanations may be true, the term is more likely the result of an outcry of Europe, in Europe, especially in Spain, against the atrocities of intermarrying Jews and Muslims. One pope, called Philip II of Spain, the spawn of infidels and Jews. The less ancestral intermarriage of Jews and Arabs, went the argument, the mere veins of white skin, generally peasant people, showed up as blue. Oh, okay, this is bizarre. Okay. Elizabeth herself, traversing England on horseback to urge loyalty to her people, did not have the luxury of remaining indoors, but back at court, she hid her weather-beaten features behind a lotion called Ceruse, a lead-based skin whitener used in ancient Rome and revised in the Renaissance. In 17th century genuine portraits, women's faces were customarily rendered as corpse-like white ovals. Later, the development of coach travel reinforced the fashion. Being pale showed you could afford a covered transport. As the Brazilian proverb has it, then as now, money bleaches. Wow. Under the Charles II, heavy makeup was a universal at court. The most perilous of beauty aids employed were white leg, arsenic, and mercury, all of which not only ruined the skin over time, but made for the hair fall out. Corroded the stomach, brought on shakes, and often killed the aspirant beauty outright. The danger in such cosmetics became widely known through the dramatic deaths of the courtesan Kitty Fisher and of Maria, Countess of Coventry, the elder of the two legendary Gunning sisters of George II's day. Kitty and Maria maintained a famous rivalry due to Kitty's affair with Maria's husband, George William. As for Maria, this is bizarre. She caught the eye of the notorious poor playboy Augustus Henry Fitzroy, 3rd Duke of Gafton, and from 1767 to 1770, functionally Britain's Prime Minister. But the effort of retaining his affections came at great cost. She died at 27 after too many years of lead-based improvements. Catherine Maria, Kitty Fisher, died in 1767, apparently from lead race preparation 7 years after her arrival. The 18th century gave way to the 19th. Whiteness continued to be the primary purpose of beauty, where there were occasional exceptions to the rule. Throughout the centuries, for instance, the Anglo-Irish gentry were effectively garrisoned community cultivated martial virtues, marital virtues in their women, whose ruddy features were evidence of their regular riding up to hounds. But while a certain kind of lady, witness Bertie Wooster's Aunt Agatha, could be windburnt, coarsened in complexion rather than tinting, it was not done to go out in the sun. The same kind of thinking found its way to America, where no southern belle or northern debutante dared go out without her parasol for fear of losing her lily-white colouring. Women of the South, at the time of the Civil War, took to chewing newspaper as they had discovered something in the ink had whitened their faces. Freckles, the result of one's melanin granules being distributed unleavening, and freckles or just unactivated high accumulations, also to be avoided. Scarlett O'Hara, younger sister Sue Ellen, finding a family carriage was momentarily stopped in the sun, cries out in dismay, "Oh, Papa, can't we get it going? I can feel the freckles popping out of my face." Even in late 1880s, ladies in societies were prepared to resort to extreme measures. The Parisian beauty Emile Gretu, the notorious Madame X of Sargent's portrait, worked hard on her appearance. Her skin was suspected by some of her rivals to be work of an enameler, and others to have been achieved by judicious doses of arsenic. But by Madame X's times, fashions were changing. In Victorian Britain, people had started to shun makeup, associating it with prostitutes and actresses, considered by many to be one of the same. Any hint of tampering with one's natural colour was frowned on as vulgar or worse. White skin as a mark of class may also have lost its claim as a result of urbanisation, and because of the changing labour patterns brought in the factories and industrial revolution. With indoor work the norm for most working class people, the pale skin was no longer a signifier of status. During the 1914-18, few officers returned from the trenches with pale skin. It was a patriotic mark to have been in the sun. Besides, the enthusiasm was beginning. Seaside holidays, which had originally been recommended for the reasons of health, were becoming a mark of a smart set. Those who had the money and time to enjoy themselves wherever they wanted, go where they're choosing to the beach, and tan skin became seen as a sign of membership of a prosperous class. As Paul Fussell recognised, from the quote, "For the Mediterranean to be reappointed after the First World War, it was most ubiquitous natural asset, the sun, had to be redeemed from the social stigma it had borne in the 19th century. Then, the better sort of people had tended not to sit in it, believing that its effects were indispensable for the welfare of flora. They were very dubious of value to persons." Going, reading this, pushing along. "Were photographed at play in suits and hats. Stephen Porter, author of a series of humorous books, Lifemanship, brilliantly caught the pallid Englishman's attitude to sunbathing at the start of the 1950s. The first action at summer weekend," he writes, "of the confirmed hostess nobler, P.E. Distinct, is to strip to the waist and sunbathe. His skin soon turns a rich honey bronze. This is when his nemesis, Cog Willoughby, strolls by. Cog Willoughby, by Jove, you brown easily. Distinct, do I? Cog Willoughby, yes. You're one of the you're lucky ones. Distinct, oh, I don't know. Cog Willoughby, they always say southern types brown more easily. Distinct, oh, well, I don't know. I'm not particularly. Cog Willoughby, oh, I don't know. Mediterranean." As Porter, Cog Willoughby was able to speak this phrase with an intonation which suggested that Distinct was Italian about it, at least, with quite probably a touch of tar brush of his ancestry as well. Thereafter, Distinct spends the rest of the weekend trying to cover up every exposed part of his body. Okay, this is pretty inane. But Porter, There were a serious combatant was fighting against the tide. Within a decade of Lifemanship being published, the reversal of skin tone preferences was complete. Bronze skin on a Caucasian signified health and social standing for reasons that were also a reversal of those that had previously favoured paleness. President John F. Kennedy was at least as obsessive as Gary Gant in his commitment to the perfect tan. During the week he was preparing his celebrated inaugural address, he spent much of the time tanning as he working on his speech. Quote, footnote, according to a recent biographer, here's a quote, in 1961, a tan was considered evidence of well-being and a way to disprove rumours about Kennedy's poor health. Hugh Sidney, who covered him for a time, remembers the whole family being obsessed with tanning. Jackie used the reflector, Bobby pursued the grail of full-body tanning, and Kennedy himself had been travelling in the sun lamps since the 1946 congressional campaign. He worked tirelessly at keeping a tan dark enough to show up on a black-and-white television. Well, there you go. That's a big picture of Kennedy tan. The downside of Kennedy's skin deteriorated rapidly. He might have looked youthful on television, in contrast to sweating Solo Nixon, but Gore Vidal, who shared a stepfather with Jackie, wrote that his step-brother-in-law looked older than he did in his photographs. The outline of a slender and youthful, but the face of heavily lined visage. The upper lip are those tiny vertical lines characterised of a more advanced age. By 1961, the sun had really been taking its toll. By the 1970s, two entire generations had baked their bodies, and by the 1990s, Disney was having trouble getting a female staff at Euro Disneyland to wear stockings. A good tan was worth flaunting. Conversely, skin whiteners and lighteners are still popular among many dark-skinned people worldwide. A label for cosmetic manufacturer in Paris but sold in Southeast Asia asserts that the product is the first technology which regulates the different steps of skin pigmentation process to perfect the whitening efficiency. In 2007, plastic surgeons in London announced that they had developed creams using plant extracts to concentrate vitamin C to lighten C. And they hope to drive backstreet suppliers of potentially dangerous preparation, often containing bleach, out of business. There's a footnote here. In David Dibnar's engrossing novel, The House of Blue Mangoes, set in India, mostly in the years before the Great War, a village doctor concocts a special potion to lighten his patient's skins. Although the story is a product of Dibnar's imagination, the author told me that his grandparents, who had lived in just such a village, use talcum powder to pale their faces, while a cream called Fair and Lovely is among the several such products still sold in India today. India's pursuit of pale appearance is known as Snow White Syndrome, although in 2010 the Indian fashion industry promoted a campaign, Dawn of Dusk, to combat the prejudice against the darker skin colour. Well, there you go. From the Hawaiian prostitutes in James Jones' 1951 novel From Here to Eternity, who were kept out of the sun to, as their surface climates preferred their women to be as white as possible, to Jennifer Lopez, Michael Jackson, and heroines of modern Japanese novels, it is still true, light-skinned people want darker skins and vice versa. Is there another footnote? Writing in the Washington Post, Jarib Asim makes the point that conventional wisdom in fashion and lifestyle magazine publishing has long held that dark faces on covers discourage mainstream purchases, which may explain why Beyoncé Knowles was the first black woman to adorn Vanity Fair cover all by herself. Since Tina Turner in 1933, Vanity Fair is not unique in its timidity. When Halle Berry appeared in the December 2002 cover of Cosmopolitan, she came the only fifth black woman to so featured, and since Naomi Campbell in 1990. When Italian Vogue of July 2008 featured black models exclusively, it was considered sufficiently newsworthy that the New York Times ran an article. News magazines show far better percentages, for example, over recently appeared on the cover of Newsweek. with most passed without comment. Nor was her complexion tampered with. Newsweek's Rifle Time had infamously proved the danger of the tactic when, in 1994, it darkened the portrait of O.J. Simpson in order to make him appear more sinister. Oh, my God, Father. The whole fashion for seaside holidays was started the trend for tans, which began with concerns about health, and eventually took on a distinctly erotic undertone. In the 1990s essay, the novelist John Fowles writes about the transformation of his hometown, Lyme Regis, in Dorset, as early as the 18th century, specifically because relief in health benefits of seeing the sun. Quote, "How can something as so nice have been ignored for so long? The change came, like most major human changes, from conjunctions of two factors. In this case, the medical profession and the first romantic spoke as one." Oh dear. This man has got enormous knowledge. In 1780, Fowles asserts the sea, its water, its air, the light and the relief it gave landscapes was all the rage. And between 1803 and 1805, Lyme played host to the most famous habitée, Jane Austen, and her family and persuasion shows her marked approval of what the town, if not its inhabitants, had to offer. As one of her characters comments, quote, "I'm quite convinced that, with very few exceptions, the sea air always does good. There can be no doubt of it having been the greatest service to Dr. Shirley after his illness. He declares himself that coming to Lyme for a month did him more good than all the medicines he took." The appeal of the French Riviera has similar origins. By the late 18th century, it had become a fashionable destination for British upper class. Its popularity was solidified and much expanded in the 1830s, when Henry Peter Boreham, Lord Chancellor of England, travelling with his ailing sister, began visiting Nice. At the time, it was more than a little fishing village on a picturesque coast, and built a house there. By the time of his death, Nice and its neighbourhood towns had become a sanatorium of Europe, and in 1874, shortly after the railway reached the Riviera, one observer calculated that between 7,000 and 8,000 English invalids annually spent the winter in the south. The health benefits of being in the sun got a booster in 1890, when German bacteriologist Robert Koch showed that sunlight was lethal to tuberculosis and bacillus. The sanatorium designers were encouraged to exploit this discovery. However, most doctors were unconvinced, and the sun's use as a medical aid in modern times is primarily due to Oscar Bernard, who, as surgeon-in-chief at the Hospital of Swiss Valley at Upper Engeldine, when on February 2nd, 1902, an Italian was admitted with severe knife injuries. 8 days after surgery, the wound still gaped wildly and an attempt to restitch it failed. The surrounding tissue was soft and spongy. The hole discharged previously, with no drying treatment having any effect, but Dr. Bernard took the usual step of exposing the patient to the sun. By the end of the first hour and a half, there was a marked improvement noticeable. The wound presented quite a different appearance. The granulations became visibly more normal and healthy. The enormous wound skin covered quickly. This is really picking at straws, metal straws. Here's a picture of these English children. English children during sun lamp treatment. Such lamps as safeguards against tuberculosis, which spread alarmingly in Europe and USA after the First World War. I think my wife's dad had tuberculosis. Bernard began to treat other patients with sunlight and found further healing effects. The discharge of foul-smelling wounds rapidly became odourless, and in addition to cleansing lesions, sunlight had an analgesic effect. He decided to treat open tuberculosis cavities in the same way. At the same time, the disease was rampant, claiming millions of lives in Europe every year. Bernard's approach was certainly widely copied. One expert declaring, quote, "Every room occupied or visited by patients should be flooded by sunlight wherever possible, because of all its disinfectant, sunlight has been shown to be the most powerful." In 1903, Daniel Niels Fission was awarded the Nobel Prize for its use of artificial sunlight to cure tuberculosis of the skin. He was the theorist, like Bernard Wittgenstein. Isn't that amazing? He was a theorist. Others, like Bernard, were the main practitioners. That same year, another physician, August Rollier, began removing his patients 5,000 feet above sea level to better catch the ultraviolet light. The first patient to be cured was his fiancée. Rollier pioneered a treatment in which very slow tanning in cool conditions was combined with rest and fresh air. A patient's feet would be uncovered first, followed gradually all over the course of 15 days by the lower legs, thighs, abdomen, chest, and finally the entire body would be exposed. It seemed to work. But treating tuberculosis with sunlight remained on the borderline of accepted medical practice. In 1905, Rollier presented his first results to Paris Ordinance. It walked out, yet at his peak was operating 36 clinics with more than 1,000 beds. The leading practitioner of heliotherapy in Britain, Sir Henry Govan, did not believe that sunlight alone could cure advanced cases, and combined the patient's exposure to sunlight with sea bathing. Okay. Collier's work attracted the notice of architects, and a number of designs for sunlit buildings increased. De Corbusier may have been the standard bearer in France, but when the war's numerous beach resorts were built in southern Britain to draw people out of their bad housing and, for a while at least, into healthy, life-enhancing sunshine, by 1933, sunlight was said to be beneficial treatment for over 165 diseases. In the years after the Second World War, it was a standard medical precept that more sun we got, the better. Schoolroom windows were made so the ultraviolet rays would penetrate easy, and boarding schools' matrons would line up their charges at bath time to stand under the sun lamps. Sun's health benefits were first taken up earnest in Germany with the treatment of wounded during the First World War, after which sunbathing was recommended for those recovering from flu epidemic in 1918-19, which killed 21 million people worldwide, and for children with vitamin deficiency ailments inflicted by Allied blockade. Almost immediately, the naturalism movement began to advocate nudity for the sake of general well-being. Indeed, nudists were the first modern sun worshippers. I suppose, yeah. After the First World War, a generation, as you can see, my mother-in-law believed that Sun Valley was a nudist camp. After the First World War, a generation of writers grew up basing their philosophies on various aspects of soul thinking. A critic, Martin Green, has labelled them Sonnenkinder, children of the sun, divided them into dandy, the rogue, and the knave, all set on bucking traditional culture. Many artists and writers were among these early disciples. One historian wrote of Rupert Burke and his intimates, "These children of the sun were the enthusiastic nudists." For him, Walt Whitman had made naked sunbathing part of his nature culture cult. And in the early 20th century, Hermann Hesse followed suit, travelling to Italy to cure his headaches and gout. For many years, sunbathers was the euphemism for nudists. While one of the first associations of Britain devoted to nudity was called the Sunbathing Society, and most naturalists belonged to sun clubs, giving naked sunbathing, and by clear implication its erotic potential, the royal nod while reveling in the East Mediterranean sun in June 1936, Edward the Eighth stripped down to demonstrate his longings for freedom on the yacht Nachan for Mrs. Simpson. I thought, well, there you go. So he was naked as well. Other European nations at first responded fitfully to the craze, but from around 1925, they set in the solar revolution, one of the most startling reversals in modern social history. By the end of the decade, the sun had become the design motif of the era, appearing in everything from cufflinks to stained glass, suburban windows, garden gates, to wireless sets. But the enthusiasm remained greatest in Germany. Stephen Spender witnessed it firsthand. Thousands of people went to the open-air swimming baths to lay down on the shores of the river and lakes, almost nude and sometimes quite nude. And the boys who had turned the deepest mahogany walked among the people with the paler skins, like kings among the courtiers. The sun healed their bodies of years of war and made them conscious of the quivering, fluttering lifeblood and muscles covering the exhausted spirits like the pelt of an animal, and their minds were filled with the obstruction of the sun. A huge circle fire, the intense whiteness blotting out the sharp outlines of all other forms of consciousness. Splendor's description also hints at the erotic charge of bearing oneself to the life-giving rays. As Fowl wrote of Limericus, here's a quote: "For the many decades, sea bathing remained what it had been to Jane Austen, a medicinal activity, and those who still braved Neptune direct did it from a wheeled cabins. But the Victorian spirit began to see the siren plainly, siren, S-I-R-E-N, that is, to sense the always implicit neuroticism and sexuality of the beach." It's not just the bodily display. The sun has always been an aphrodisiac. Hot had the meaning of lustful well before 1500. Only under the sun did Lawrence Durrell could the essential male and female relationship flourish, the uncomplicated by marriages and falsities. His fellow novelist, Henry Green, went further. The weather lies at the root of the way women and men behave. With the result, the English in their relations with each other are less frank than those of the nations to extent to which the skies are less clear, so by less amount of sun they have. And indeed, many English people looked with dismay at the new fashion and the skimpiness of the attire that was part of its appeal. In Alan Hubert's Misleading Cases, he creates the story of a man arrested around 1920 for wearing a bathing drawers, but not a full bathing suit. The newspapers in 1925 records how the south coast town of Bournemouth attendants are empowered to prevent visitors from sitting on the beach in their swimming costumes, and bathers were commanded to walk straight into the sea and straight back to their bathing tents. Sunbathing continued to be banned in Bournemouth until early 1930s. Then, and as late as 1941, Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun, sunbathing is presented as close to exhibitionism. Here's a footnote. One of the 12 signs by which the anti-terrorist agents are supposed to be recognized male suicide bombers is that they will have paler skins than the lower half of their face, as they will have shaved off their beards to help them blend in with the less suspicious. If their chins have no recent exposure to the sun. Well, isn't that incredible? I don't know why this has got so much information. Albert Camus, 1913-60, the great French Algerian chronicle of philosophical dread and human absurdities, has provided the nearest to what one might call the philosophy of sunbathing. In 1939, in Summers in Algiers, a long essay on its pleasures, he wrote, "Algiers and a few other privileged coastal towns open into the sky like a mouth or a wound. One fell in love and the foremost with the sea, but also a certain heaviness of sunlight. Following from that was not sunbathing hedonism of the rich, but the delights of the poor and the dispossessed, whose pleasures have no remedies and whose joys remain without hope. In summer, young men go down to the sea and enjoy the water's gentle warmth and the women's brown bodies. Quote. Here's another quote here. Not that they have read boring sermons of our nudists, those Protestants of the body. They're just like being in the sun. It would be hard to exaggerate the significance of the custom of nowadays. For the first time in 2,000 years, the body has been shown naked on the beaches. Swimming in the harbour in the summertime, you notice that everybody's skin changes at the same time from white to gold, then to brown, and at last to tobacco hue. The final stage of the body can attain the quest of transformation. Weird question. More prosaically, in 1986, a leading dermatologist commented, "Why does everyone insist on tanning their hide? Because it's sexy? It's a cultural characteristic. A sign of health." Okay. Again, sort of, yeah, reaching, I suppose it's my preference, the social analysis. So we've looked at sunbathing from TB to nudism.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.